Welcome to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Over the next hour, you'll be introduced to business and local leaders impacting our community. Text your comments or questions directly to the studio at 540-371-5756. And now, the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
Scott Harrison and Catherine Willison this morning bringing Eliza home, our topic. This is a great story that Catherine Willis, you first introduced me to in the spring. You and Sue Henderson were in, and we did one of these shows and talked about Eliza Monroe, the daughter of James Monroe. I did not know anything of the story, and you sold me on it.
Well, you are not alone in not knowing much about Eliza Monroe Hay, because for almost 200 years, her life, her story, her contributions to the American presidency during her father's administration were buried deep and forgotten. During her lifetime, Eliza was, she was maligned, and even her family thought that later in life she abandoned her children, went to Paris to live the high life, and never came home again. That is so far from true.
That's so interesting. We're going to talk all about that and get into it. Sort of, the James Monroe Museum over the weekend did just a great program to kind of talk about this, and we'll talk about that too. But as you, Scott Harris, the executive director of UMW Museum, is also here this morning. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, thank you. And I just want to correct one thing at the beginning. You said Scott Harris and Catherine Willis were here. Catherine Willis is here, and I'm her wingman. So let's be clear on the order of precedence.
I understand that, yes.
Okay,
I think you're right.
Just now, wanted to do that.
It's very kind.
One of the things that came out at the museum program the other day, is as you talked about Eliza, I thought this is in some ways sort of like Mary Washington, of just where stories get told and things get understood and they become over the years accepted, and you're correct, you both and others are kind of correcting some wrongs.
I think that's a very good point, and I will tip my hat to you. I had not really thought of that relationship between those two, but you're very correct. I mean, the traditional story of Mary Washington was that she, you know, hectored her son while he's trying to, you know, create the country, and this was a burden on him. And our friends at the Washington Heritage Museums, Ann Darren, friend of this show, mm-hmm. And the folks that work there have helped do a lot to rehabilitate her image and tell a much more balanced story. And I think that this is certainly what Catherine Willis and Sue Henderson, Barbara Vorndick, and many others have done in more recent times to help provide another perspective on Eliza Monroe Hay, who in her life and later certainly bore a lot of criticism. Not to say that she was perfect or an angel, but she was not the demon that she was characterized to be by some.
Well, go ahead. You want to say something, Catherine?
Well, I was going to talk a little bit about Eliza's life. I think contextualizing that way will show why it was so important to bring her home. She spent her early childhood on Lower Caroline, right here in Fredericksburg. After Monroe's military service, he attended William & Mary, became a lawyer, and he had family ties in Fredericksburg through his mother's family, and they encouraged him to move to Fredericksburg to begin his law career. And his law practice, a small building that stands partially on, that stood on ground that is now partially the James Monroe Museum, was his first law office.
Yeah.
And he was a rector at St. George's Church. More than likely, Eliza was baptized in St. George's. So they're deep, long-lasting Fredericksburg ties.
The great thing about this story is that come the 23rd, there's a conclusion to this part of the story.
Right. So after a long and arduous journey, Eliza has been exhumed from an unmarked grave in Père Lachaise, where she was ignominiously buried with scant ceremony, and her gravesite was not even marked. Part of the shroud of mystery that envelops her entire story. But yes, she was transferred from France to the United States. She landed at Dulles, was met there by Barbara Vaughn Dick, who is the principal mover in this, and also by Julie Found of Found and Sons Funeral Home here in Fredericksburg.
Yeah.
And Julie and her professional associates received Eliza, filled out the paperwork, saw the transfer, saw that the transfer was legally done, and she was taken from Dulles to Fredericksburg to Found and Sons Funeral Home, where she now resides. She will be interred on Thursday, October 23rd at 2 p.m. at Hollywood Cemetery in Richmond in the Monroe family plot, and it is open to the public and there is no charge.
Catherine, this has to be just thrilling for you. I mean, when we did the show in, it was February or March, we did it, and this, everything was still so up in the air, and you didn't know if it was going to be approved.
Boy, that is so true. After having been ignored and forgotten for so many years, there was a flurry of concern about the legality of exhuming her. And Père Lachaise and the city of Paris, which operates Père Lachaise, are very, very exacting about the details required to get permission to exhume a body. And boy, was this complicated, because Eliza died penniless and had no monies in her estate for a funeral mass or a burial. And so Daniel Brent, who was then the consul at the American Embassy in Paris, saw on his list of Americans in Paris that Eliza had died. Daniel Brent was duly shocked, because he had been in Monroe's early administration. He had been a friend of the Monroe family. And so he took it upon himself to purchase a plot, purchase a gravestone for her, and to pay for a funeral mass so that she could be interred with some kind of dignity. As he said himself, not equal to the state of her standing and what she was due, but it was still respectable.
Boy, how fortunate it was that he was there and knew, you know, had some background, or this story would, you know, she would have been lost.
Yeah, I mean, as consul, he would have done this, generally speaking, for any American, certainly any well-known American, who had the misfortune to die in Paris at that time. I think it was doubly poignant that he knew the family. He was close to the family. He had, as Catherine had served in the Monroe administration, from Stafford County, by the way, too. So there's another local tie to this story. And it's Daniel Brent who helped give her a resting place that, as said, not equal to her station, as one would expect, but it would be there and would be largely forgotten, unfortunately, until a couple of people about a decade or ago started to really dig into this. William Colligan, who was a former guide at the James Monroe Museum, frequent visitor to France, very interested in French history and the connections with this country, had made some initial inquiries. The museum had heard from the cemetery that there had been actually a collapse or damage to her grave, and that there was a danger, since it was intended that her bones might go into an ossuary, just be commingled with others. That turned out to be incorrect. It was the monument next to hers that had been damaged, but it still focused attention.
Yeah.
And then enter one Catherine Willis, who not only has the sister city connection and family in France to help sort of stage this, she took it upon herself to go and mount an effort to specify the location of the grave, to clean it of literally centuries of debris and plant growth, and to mark it in an appropriate way. So that part of the story, the sort of the rediscovery, is sort of act one of this, and act two has been the repatriation. And it's just a great closure that's coming with this interment in Hollywood on the 23rd.
Quick break, we're going to come back. I'm so happy to have the two of you, because really this story, that was a great background, Scott, and this story began, really started to take shape with a letter that came to you, and we'll talk about that when we come back on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
Welcome back to Town Talk on News Talk 1230. You can weigh in about today's topic on Facebook at WFVA 1230 and by text at 540-371-5756. And now, here's your host, Ted Schubel.
It is Bring Eliza Home. That's our focus this morning with Catherine Willis and Scott Harris as we talk about again, it's not often, Scott, that you do a story like this and that we do it where there's going to be this has been a long term sort of story over the last year and a half or so, and even longer probably. But there's a conclusion. She's coming home, Hollywood Cemetery in Richmond, and we'll again continue to talk about all that. But this all began, I guess, I learned this the other day when you got a letter came to the James Monroe Museum.
It did, and Catherine's going to help me again on the year.
2018.
It was 2018, that's right, because I had just made a transition to being executive director of museums, but I even thought it was earlier than that, but okay, wow. This has been compressed even more than I realized. The museum was understood to be what we are, the sort of the custodian, one of them, and steward of the Monroe legacy overall, James Monroe, obviously, his life and career, and his family. And that's appropriate because it was founded by descendants of Monroe in the 1920s, operated by the James Monroe Memorial Foundation for many years until that entity gave it to the Commonwealth. So there's the pedigree of our museum. But it was something that even in the earlier history, when Lawrence Gouverneur Hughes, the founding director, great-great-grandson of Monroe from the other line, not Eliza's line, but that of Mariah Monroe Gouverneur. He was the director. He had some conversations with officials in France regarding the grave, but they never really went anywhere. There was just not, I think, enough will, enough interest, perhaps, to try to do anything to better mark, or I don't know that anyone even ever thought about bringing her remains back, but even the simple act of doing something more appropriate for where she was buried, it just never seemed to amount to anything. And so decade after decade, this situation sort of festered, and nature was reclaiming the site, as it will do. And it just seemed like this was sort of an impasse, and that, you know, what could be done? Well, as I've said before, never underestimate a group of determined women. And it was a group of determined women who really were the spirit of this. Many, many people have a role that they played in this, and organizations, and I'm sure we'll reference some of them. But this core of women, Barbara Vorndick, as mentioned, Catherine, who already had some time in service on this project, Sue Henderson, well-known in our area, those three and others really brought a focus to this and a desire to see it through, and that is what is happening.
So you got the letter, then what did you do next?
Well, we were trying to really figure out what to do. We did not have the budget or really were empowered by any official agency to do anything. Eliza Monroe's Monroe Hayes remains, whatever might happen to them, would have to be ultimately done with the permission of her descendants. And so that would be one thing that might occur. But the gravesite was in the property of Daniel Brent and his descendants. And Brent died only a year or so after this episode with Eliza's death. So and left no direct heirs. So just the idea of trying to run down the ancestor or the descendants lists to get the permissions was one thing. And I don't want this to sound uncaring, but the museum was just not in a position financially or structurally to be able to do very much at that point. We understood there's something had to be done. And that's when Catherine particularly and others, I mentioned William Colligan, they really stepped up and said, no, we can help. We can do something to this. And Catherine in particular took herself to France, found some help, charmed the bright people at Père Lachaise and rolled up her sleeves, literally, yeah. Cleared the stuff away, procured a wonderful, attractive ceramic topper, I guess you would call it, a flower arrangement that amazingly nobody stole or vandalized for the last 10 years or so or whatever, and broke the logjam that so far institutions have not been able to really break through, but individuals did, and that's what's great.
So this letter was in very formal French, and Scott handed it to me. He said, you can help with this. So I read it, and it said, Eliza's grave is in gross ill repair, and if it is not tended to, they will exhume her bones, put them in the ossuary, and sell the site. So
wow.
I took a copy of the letter and finally got an appointment with the director of Père Lachaise, who looked at the letter, looked at the row and the number in that row that was attributed to be Eliza's grave. And he said, that's not Eliza's grave. And he opened up this big plat book from the mid-1840s and said, that grave is here. Eliza is right next to her, to that grave.
Yeah.
I said, can you walk with me up there and make sure I know which one? And we did. There is an American section of the Père Lachaise Cemetery way far up on the hill to the right. So we trudged up there, and the grave that had failed was that of an American banker who had a Washington-style obelisk placed on his grave. But when the grave was settling, the obelisk fell over, broke the stone, and it really was caved in, covered with ivy and moss, nasty. But it was very grandiose, as are many of those monuments there surrounding Eliza.
Yeah.
Eliza's was covered in ivy, and it looked just like a piece of dirt. He said, this is Eliza's gravesite. And I think part of the reason, and it was so confusing, is that there is no number on the stone, no marking on the stone at all, or even on the base, to identify it. Anonymous, just buried, forgotten, and anonymous. So I asked him, I said, can we have this engraved? And he said, you cannot touch this. This is the property of the Daniel Brint family. And I said, well, can I clean it? And he gave me the French moo shrug.
The Gallic shrug. I wish you could have seen it.
And I thought, I'll take that as a yes.
And so you did. And, I mean, I've seen pictures of you.
So I did. But the important thing here is that, in a way, it was a blessing, because if they hadn't sent that letter, this would not have begun to roll. And it was their error that made us realize how vulnerable this grave was. When I returned and showed Scott pictures, and we looked into having the state of Virginia maintain it, we soon found out that the state of Virginia cannot own or manage property outside of the state. So that did that.
Yeah.
And that was the emphasis for getting the ball rolling on the project.
That's right, and that was something that we did consult our attorney at the time, and you know, the university's attorney is an assistant attorney general, so we were going right to the epicenter of Virginia's legal hierarchy, and it just was not, again, institutionally possible for us to take over any responsibility directly for that. Now, I don't want to say that there aren't things we could have done, but it just did not seem at the time within, again, the resources we had.
Sure.
That we could find an effective way to deal with this. It was one of those things like, we've got to figure out something to do. And fortunately, we had the solution. She's sitting next to me right now at the other microphone. But and now she's waving her hand. No. But no, it's true. I mean, I don't think we can say enough about the degree of pluck and initiative that and empathy that Catherine showed toward this. And she's not alone at all. But at the time when she was really diving into this, she was pretty much alone, and she deserves that recognition for being the person who could affect change at the right time, and it was positive change.
And just that you knew your way around France, and that you and I have done so many shows on the sister city, so you knew your way around, and that's what makes this story just so remarkable.
Well, let me continue on with the narrative, because concurrently with my discoveries about the gravesite in Paris, Barbara Vaughn Dick, who is a tour guide at Highland, which is one of James Monroe's historic properties. It's in Albemarle County, had found that Mariah Monroe, Gouverneur, had much more information, but there was nothing on Eliza. Hmm. So this just happened to come up concurrently. And so Scott actually introduced Barbara and me. And Barbara was in the process of researching Eliza's genealogy. And then, when the news came that there was no way that we could mark the grave or take care of it, that was the concept. We have to get her home. And so we did.
And that will happen on the 23rd at Hollywood Cemetery in Richmond. We need to take a break and come back. Still, I still think you are the two most valuable people in this, and I am so happy to have you here this morning talking about it, just because so much of it revolved around you, and especially you, Catherine.
You're half right.
You, Catherine, are just you are the rock star in all of this. Catherine Willis, Scott Harris here. Scott's the executive director of the UMW Museums, and Catherine is just
a
rock star, just a rock star. Bringing Eliza home. Our focus more on News Talk 1230 WFVA. It is 8:30.
From the Fredericksburg FreePress.com studios, this is News Talk 1230 WFVA Fredericksburg, a Centennial Broadcasting Station. This is Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Miss a part of the show? No problem. Just subscribe to the Town Talk podcast on your favorite podcast platform. And now, here's your host, Ted Schubel.
Scott Harris, Catherine Willis in this morning, bringing Eliza home, our focus. And now, Catherine, you wanted to continue and pick up the story that we have been talking about.
Yes. So, Barbara Vaughn Dick, who is the director or chair of this project, I cannot praise her enough for her dedication. It was she who created and researched the genealogy of Eliza and all of her descendants, and tracked them down, got their permission, determined a spokesperson for them, and got the legal papers that gave permission to exhume that body.
So this doesn't happen without that.
It doesn't. And when Barbara sent the information to Père Lachaise, it just sat and sat. So she contacted the American Embassy in Paris, who then became our good ally, and all of the information that was delivered after that was hand-carried by somebody on the staff of the American Embassy and put in the hands of the director himself, which helped move things along. When all of that was approved, and by the way, it had to be professionally checked by licensed genealogists and also professionally translated by professional French translators.
Wow.
All of that was checked. And then Père Lachaise came back and said, oh, but wait, the Eliza descendants do not own this grave. It is the descendants of Daniel Brent. As Scott already noted, Daniel Brent's wife and two children predeceased her. And so Daniel Brent left his estate to his brother, William, who had 12 children.
Oh, no.
So she had to research their descendants, have it translated, and have it certified professionally, and sent to Père Lachaise. Fortunately, Père Lachaise required only one of the Brent descendants to be the representative, and that was the Rosetta Stone. The doors finally opened. But credit must go to Barbara in this research, yeah, because concurrently she was also uncovering primary resources and documents, newspaper articles and letters and records that had heretofore been buried, and some of them had actually been misfiled. She contacted the church, Saint-Philippe du Roule in Paris, where Eliza had been, her burial ceremony had taken place. They searched their archives, which not only certified that the funeral mass was said there, but also they had the funeral mass and the interment in the parish record, which was another piece of evidence which verified what actually happened to Eliza. Barbara and I have worked closely. I was in charge of communications and public relations. I wrote many articles, presented programs, and worked concurrently with Barbara on this.
Boy, the two of you, I mean, this is like going to the DMV and having to and having to do things. The number of things that you had to do and how the goalposts kept getting changed on you when you thought you were finally to the conclusion, and then, but wait, there's more. Mm-hmm. So this is really a story.
And this effort, as Democratic, Republican, as you can imagine, a people-led effort, started to move institutions and governments. You know, Senator Bryce Reeves and staff had a hand in this. Congressional delegations did. Ultimately, the State Department. I mean, this was literally an international affair that had to be conducted. And it was as populist as you can imagine in its origin, and it eventually moved institutions on both sides of the Atlantic to make it happen. And it's really, in many ways, it's a classic American story of deciding to do something like this and getting it done. And I think on the eve of our 250th birthday as a nation that James Monroe helped fight for and took a bullet for to create and spent so much of his career pursuing the advancement of our country, taking his family with him, taking Eliza, taking her sister, Mariah, their mother Elizabeth, on all of his overseas postings, that gave the children a wider perspective on the world and not only their father's place in it, but theirs. It's a family knew a great deal of tragedy. Within a few days of each other in 1830, Eliza lost her husband, George Hay, and then her mother 2 days later, Elizabeth Monroe. Her father would die the next year, 1831. So she had already known grief, her own child, and some disaffection with the family over the estate and over inheritance, and these things just combined to go where she had been happiest, at least in one part of her life, I think, because in her youth she went to school with Napoleon's stepdaughter, Hortense de Barnet, who became the Queen of Holland, named her own daughter after her. And I think that she associated many happy moments in her life with France and sought a little bit of an escape, not by the evidence that's been gathered, an intentional, permanent thing. She didn't run away and hide. You know, she was, by all assumptions and evidence, going to come back. I don't know if she had a clear plan for it, and unfortunately, fate caught up with her on again on the other side of the Atlantic. But now faith has, and hard work has brought her back.
Eliza went to France, not on a pleasure voyage. She bought a ticket on a packet ship, which is a swift transport for letters and correspondence, and also for cargo. She was advised to sail to France because her health was failing. Tuberculosis was everywhere. She had nursed tubercular patients, including her daughter, Hortensia.
And her father.
And her father,
That's
exactly.
That's what David Rowe would die of.
Mm-hmm. Right. And when her father died in 1831, her father named Samuel Gouverneur his executor. Samuel Gouverneur had married Eliza's much younger sister, Maria. Samuel Gouverneur was also a lawyer, and so he represented the Monroe estate in legal matters, and he was the only male in that immediate family. And when Eliza tried to pursue, excuse me, gaining her inheritance, Samuel Gouverneur, as a talented lawyer and a charismatic bon vivant, was able to get it postponed or insisted there had to be another legal maneuver before the estate could be settled, et cetera, et cetera. So from 1831 to 1838, when Eliza sailed to France, Eliza had expended a lot of her inheritance from her husband, yeah, George Hay, in pursuing her estate, but to no end. She never received a cent. Mm. That's how she wound up in Paris, penniless. And I think Scott is right. There's no evidence, but Hortensia, her dear friend, had died a few years earlier. We have excerpts from letters from Eliza where she is approaching people at court and in the French circles that her father had been in to try to elicit some kind of support for somebody to be her hero, because she was a woman and had no standing in the courts.
Yeah, we forget that.
Mm-hmm. One powerful person who did come somewhat to her aid was Pope Gregory the 16th.
Yes.
In an act of what I think was to some degree charity as well as gratitude, he had presented her with a bracelet, a gold bracelet, that was in part intended to acknowledge and recognize the help her father had given in his official capacity to Catholics. I think it was also a recognition of her faith journey that she was undertaking, but also perhaps, this is my speculation, maybe he thought it might serve as some collateral for her, uh-huh, to borrow against, to help try and get her out of this cycle that she had found herself in of
You're
just
right.
being, you know, bereft of money at that moment, at least not enough to make her way out. Catholic nuns were helping care for her at a certain point. So
right.
she declined rapidly and sought help. It just wasn't enough and in time to prevent her demise while still in Paris.
Right. And those early years in Paris when her father was in diplomatic service for the United States, the James and Elizabeth Monroe enrolled her in Madame Campan's finishing school. Madame Campan had been at court. Many of her relatives had been guillotined. And yet she managed to come out alive. And so in order to maintain her livelihood, she started a girls' school in Paris. And Eliza was schooled there in French, of course, but also other languages, in history, in etiquette. And also they were, part of the regimen was that the young women had to cook a meal and give it to the poor once a week. So Eliza was raised unusually and became a dear friend of Hortensia, which we had already established. She became the wife of Napoleon's brother and became Queen of Holland thereby.
But yeah, that's her daughter. Hortense de Bernay was the childhood friend, the stepdaughter of Napoleon, and Hortensia is the daughter who did, as Catherine said, marry into the Bonaparte family, would be the mother of Napoleon III, who would be Emperor of France later in the 1860s. And as I have to bring it back to James Monroe, as I did the other day, that emperor from that bloodline putting a puppet government in Mexico in the 1860s was one of the first tests of the Monroe Doctrine that Eliza's father had promulgated. So these lines of connection that go back and forth with each other. Madame Campan being a lady-in-waiting of Marie Antoinette, who had just met her end when Monroe was beginning that Paris mission in the 1790s. And her brother, Citizen Genet, was a French representative, causing a lot of stir in this country politically. And so these lines of interaction just cross all over each other.
Wait, to have the James Monroe Museum here to be able to do, some mighty work in all of this, and to be able to provide some backing and some historical context, that can't be ignored either.
Well, no, I appreciate that, and I think it is the culmination of a lot of work that began really almost 100 years ago with the founding of the museum.
Yeah.
By Rose Duchene Gouverneur Hoos and Lawrence, her son, who would be our director for 51 years. Put an indelible stamp on things, having the family pedigree to bring to it. I think also, though, for us, our role in a more contemporary way, really we were making lots of introductions in this. We were connecting the right people to then take things forward.
Yes. Before we get too far along with Eliza's story, I want to just say that everyone is invited to the interment 2 p.m. at Hollywood Cemetery in Richmond. If you go to the Hollywood Cemetery website, you will find a illustrated map that clearly marks where the Monroe family plot is. It will not be a long ceremony. Senator Bryce Reeves will speak, as he and his office were quite supportive and instrumental in helping do some connections for this, so he will speak. But prior to that, at 11 a.m. at the Cathedral of the Sacred Heart, 823 Cathedral Place in Richmond, there will be a Catholic Mass for the Dead to honor Eliza prior to her reinterment.
And this is all on October the 23rd.
October the 23rd.
Which is a Thursday. It's a weekday. So plan on Richmond weekday traffic. Parking is limited and scarce, really, around the cemetery area, and it's going to be heavily, I think, invested. So you might do some walking. Bring sensible shoes.
Yes.
And the Hollywood Cemetery website recommends the VCU West Main Street parking deck, 801 West Main Street. Also, there is going to be an SAR color guard to add some pomp to the funeral ceremony. Several DARs and SARs will also be represented. The wreath laying will be part of this ceremony. So it's going to be a religious ceremony as well as a patriotic one. And we would love to see many people there to pay their respects.
2 p.m. at the Hollywood Cemetery on October the 23rd. We can take one final break, and we'll conclude this morning as we talk about bringing Eliza home with Catherine Willis and Scott Harris on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
This is Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. You can listen to Town Talk anytime, day or night. Just subscribe to the Town Talk podcast on your favorite podcast platform. And now, here's your host, Ted Schubel.
Great stuff this morning with Scott Harrison and Catherine Willis as we talk about bringing Eliza home. Just a few more minutes left. Catherine, you wanted to, thank some organizations that really have played a big part in this.
Absolutely. First off, Anubis International Assistance is an international company that manages body repatriation and transportation. The president was The president of this was in Southeast Asia, flew back to Paris to make sure that his company oversaw the remains and was delighted to be involved. Yeah. And, of course, all of that was pro bono. He and some of his colleagues will be at the reinterment, and we are honored by that. I can't praise Chris Snyder enough. He is an assistant to State Senator Bryce Reeves, and he has been—he's done yeoman's work. Of course, Found and Sons and Julie Found, in particular, pro bono and very professional. Historic Fredericksburg Foundation housed our website and also received our 501c3 pass-through donations. James Monroe's Highland, of course. Oatlands Historic House and Gardens up in Loudoun County hosted a small reception for Eliza shortly after her arrival. The City of Fredericksburg gave us a citation to give their imprimatur and support this effort. Several DARs, the James Monroe Memorial Foundation, of course the museum, and then the Virginia Art and Architectural Review Board. Are you hearing all of this?
There's a lot of people involved.
It is, and it is layered in complication and regulation.
Sure.
The Virginia Department of General Services has been very helpful in organizing and supporting the event itself. Of course, the United States Embassy in Paris, the Virginia Society of Sons of the American Revolution has provided us honor guards at every turn. And the color and respect that they bring adds such a cachet to all of these events. I'm so grateful and frankly overwhelmed at the support and all the connections that came together to make this possible.
I can't imagine how you two are going to feel on the 23rd.
Well, I'm going to be admiring and grateful, and Catherine, I think, is going to probably need a vacation.
Yes.
Maybe go to Paris.
Go to Paris. Scott, before we get out of here, the James Monroe Museum has, in UMW museums, I know, have a lot of events going on.
Yeah, this has really been obviously about the subject at hand, but I did want to do my due diligence and just note that both the James Monroe Museum and Gary Melcher's Home and Studio continue to have a variety of public programs as we go into the fall. Of course, we're open all the time for visitors, but if you go to umw.edu/arts/museums, you'll be at a landing page that you can then go individually to Gary Melcher's Home and Studio website or the James Monroe Museum website. We're celebrating 50 years of Gary Melcher's Home and Studio being open to the public and 70 years since Corinne Melcher's and her will bequeath the property to the Commonwealth. So we're putting a big focus on that, especially for members of Friends of Belmont, which people are invited to join. The James Monroe Museum continues into the fall with lectures on the American Revolution in the South, and also the annual Monroe Lecture will be one of our last, really our last program that sort of looks at the legacy of James Monroe's presidency now that we reach the end of 8 years of the bicentennial of that presidency.
Yeah.
And we have Bob Karachuk from the Papers of James Monroe and Lindsay Stravinsky, the librarian at Mount Vernon, a presidential historian in her own right. She's director of the library. So they're going to really be discussing sort of the culmination of that observance of Monroe's presidential years, which, of course, Eliza Monroe was a great aide to her mother, whose health was not strong during her years as First Lady, and Eliza stepped in and help do many of those duties. So it all comes back to the subject at hand, but we did want to note that our museums have other stuff going on too.
What a great show. Thank you.
Oh, it was
Catherine, thank you for teaching me in much of this year about Eliza Monroe Haynes.
Well, you know, I am a Francophile from early years, and I had just finished 2 years' work with Lafayette. And
right. Now
Lafayette
this.
Almost certainly knew Eliza because when he was on his tour, he was
Thanks
entertained
for listening
at
to Town
Oak Hill
Talk.
5 James Talk Monroe, and Eliza
WFVA. Thank you
the
both.
Views expressed
we'll talk
by
soon.
The
host Thank
and
you.
Guests on
That's
this
it. Thank you for
are
listening.
Their own and not necessarily those of this station, its management, or Centennial Broadcasting. Hear the show anytime by subscribing to the Town Talk podcast on your favorite podcast platform. The Glenn Beck Program is next on News Talk 1230 WFVA.